It's Diane. This is my new podcast called Diane Rehm on My Mind. With the news that Israel plans to build 2,500 new housing units in the West Bank, I wanted to look at the future of America's relationship with Israel under a Trump presidency. So we've asked two people who follow the issue closely to join us. Aaron David Miller is Vice President for New Initiatives, a distinguished fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Peter Baker is Chief White House Correspondent for The New York Times. And Aaron David Miller, I want to start with you. Give me your reaction to the news that Israel plans to build 2,500 housing units in the West Bank.
I mean, I think you'd have to be living in a galaxy far, far away not to have seen this coming. You basically have a perfect storm. You have an incoming administration that is going to have a much stronger pro-Israeli sensibility. You've got a peace process that may not be dead and buried, but it's dead. You have an outgoing administration that, at least on the settlement issue, toward its end, in the UN Security Council resolution, the Kerry speech in the Paris International Conference, at least the prime minister took to be fundamentally critical. And you have an Israeli right wing that is pressing a prime minister for action that go beyond simply expansion of settlements and intensification of building in East Jerusalem. So I think this is Happy New Year. I think this was predictable. And I think there'll be more of it in the future.
Peter, do you agree?
Yeah, what was fascinating was to be in the White House when this was announced. And at the briefing, Sean Spicer, the new White House press secretary, was asked about this. And in the past, what you would have heard from presidents of either party would have been at least some degree of concern, some degree of outrage even, depending on the moment, at the Israelis once again moving forward when the United States has asked them not to. Whole different situation. Sean Spicer said, well, it's something we're going to talk about, but he had no words of condemnation, no words of concern, no words of even ambivalence about the idea of more settlement construction. Remember, of course, President Trump has said he's more or less for it, and he's got a new ambassador, David Friedman, who hasn't been confirmed yet, but he's been nominated, who is an avid proponent of more construction in the West Bank. So it's a new day both in Israel and here in Washington.
So, Peter, does this look like a much friendlier relationship between the U.S. and Israel?
It does. Just a few days ago, President Trump and Prime Minister Netanyahu talked by phone. The president invited the prime minister to visit Washington next month. We don't have a date yet, but it'll be soon. And you hear a lot more back and forth and a lot more conversations. Ron Dermer, the ambassador from Israel to the United States, is said to be in regular touch with Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law and senior advisor. And you see just more of a convergence of viewpoints these days than you did certainly under President Obama, who took a very different view of the settlements construction and other policies that Prime Minister Netanyahu had advanced.
So, Aaron, what kind of short-term changes might we see?
I mean, I think in the three areas that constituted the most tense dysfunctional aspects of the Obama-Netanyahu relationship, there will be a sort of easing of tensions. Number one, the personal relationship. I think, at least for now, I think you're going to see a purposeful, willful effort on the part of both Netanyahu and the president not to surprise one another and basically to get along. Second, there'll probably be more coordination on Iran, which has proven to be so problematic over the course of the last 5 or 6 years. And finally, I don't think you're going to see the attention and willfulness of the previous administration application of efforts to move the Israeli-Palestinian issue forward under a Trump administration. I will say, and I think Peter's right, that you are going to see – you were in a honeymoon period. But I would bet, and I hate making predictions, but I've watched the U.S.-Israeli relationship for a long time. And I would bet you that within a year or so, this initial honeymoon is going to enter a new phase. Now, that's complete speculation. It's counterintuitive. It's fundamentally different than the narrative that the conventional narrative that's been identified now. But I think there are a number of factors which, in my mind, will drive it to a much more complicated place.
Like
first of
what?
All, is the possibility that the Israelis will overreach. You know, for the last 8 years, Mr. Netanyahu, who is a very risk-averse Israeli prime minister, this is not Ariel Sharon, this is not Rabin. This is a guy who's fundamentally cautious, attentive to domestic politics, for the last several years, he's been able to use the Obama administration as a certain break and measure of restraint on those who want to go well beyond what he's doing right now, which is fairly conventional in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. There's calls for annexation of certain incorporation of certain areas in the West Bank into Israel proper. Naftali Bennett is pushing, frankly, for blanket annexation of large parts of the West Bank. So that's one. Number two, where you stand in life has a good deal to do with where you sit. And there's a certain reality. Jerusalem and Washington are sitting in very different places. Mr. Trump may not choose to renegotiate or abrogate the Iran agreement. And you may increasingly find separation there between the Israeli position on what to do about Iran and the American position. Finally, you do have two very willful, purposeful personalities who are very suspicious by nature, whose egos are quite large. And I suspect that if, in fact, they get into a tussle, that sooner rather than later, they're going to be annoying one another. But I think for now, no question, the U.S.-Israeli relationship has nowhere to go but up.
Peter, going back to the settlement cell, what are the Palestinians likely to do when they see these 2,500 settlements start to go up?
Well, I think you're seeing, obviously, already some protests in the streets in the West Bank over the plans to possibly move the American embassy to Jerusalem. You're seeing more conversations and more threats from Palestinian Authority as well as their Arab friends in Jordan and elsewhere about whether they might eventually rescind their recognition of Israel. Some of that's heated rhetoric may not actually prove to be what happens, but you can see the beginning of a new era of tension. I mean, there's always been tension, but you can see it ratcheting back up again. Now, these particular settlement housing units that have been approved mostly seem to be in what are being called the settlement blocks. These are parts of the West Bank where there are already a lot of Israeli houses. And the Israelis would say, well, look, these are the parts of the West Bank that under any settlement between the two peoples would ultimately be part of Israel. They would give land swaps to the Palestinians in compensation. What could happen, what would be even more provocative, is if they start doing more settlement construction outside of those settlement blocks, outside of the areas that people do tend to generally think might be part of an Israeli state under the final settlement. And that would be even more in your face and certainly generate a fiercer reaction.
I want to ask you both about the idea of moving the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. Peter, other presidents have tried to do this as well. Explain the significance and what it would mean if Trump simply did this on his own.
Sure, yes. Other presidents have, both President Clinton and President Bush, the 43, promised as candidates to move the embassy to Jerusalem. Congress even passed a law in the 1990s saying that the embassy should be in Jerusalem, but it allowed a president to sign a waiver saying, well, we got to put it off for now. And both President Clinton and President Bush signed those waivers every 6 months. President Obama came in and did the same thing. And the reason is that if you were to move an embassy there now, the idea is that that might prejudge the final status of these various issues that remain between the Israelis and Palestinians. Number one among which, or at least one of the top ones, of course, is the status of Jerusalem. Both sides claim Jerusalem as their capital. And, you know, pretty much everybody understands that if there is a two-state solution, it means that the West Jerusalem would be Israeli and the East Jerusalem would be Palestinian. But to put the embassies there now, some people feel would prejudge and also provoke a tough reaction from the Arabs, possibly violence. And so that's why, in fact, no foreign country currently has an embassy in Jerusalem. They all have them in Tel Aviv if they have them there at all.
Aaron, do you want to comment?
I think initially, and I've written about this, I was more persuaded that that this administration was going to do this actually relatively quickly. I think indications now are that they're slow walking it. And I think they're slow walking it in large part because I think they understand that such a move right now is neither wise nor warranted. And I suspect if Mr. Tillerson is confirmed, I suspect he will be, and now that Jim Mattis is confirmed, that President Trump is also going to hear from these two that this is really not a good idea, that there is no compelling U.S. national interest, certainly right now, to undertake a unilateral action. Remember, this is not something the Israelis are doing. This is something we're doing. which would strip away any pretense or even the illusion that we can maintain a degree of detachment and objectivity as an effective or honest broker in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. If we do this, we are essentially recognizing Israeli sovereignty, which is something they don't even have an officially declared. They've extended Israeli law. But we're sending a signal that that the Jerusalem Enterprise is, in fact, wholly owned by Israel. And I think even if there is no peace process right now, this would be it's completely unnecessary and provocative, and I think it will open up a box of troubles.
But what about Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner? Trump says he can fix the Israeli-Palestinian issue.
You know, Diane, I wish my father-in-law had as much confidence in me as Jared Kushner's father-in-law seems to have in him with respect to what is now Mission Impossible. The fact is, in my judgment, it's not the man or woman in the middle that sits between Israelis and Palestinians that's the problem, that's impeding why we don't have a two-state solution. It's the Israelis and Palestinians themselves, the absence of leadership, the absence of ownership, and I would argue since Bush 41 and Jim Baker, the absence of effective American mediation. So I wish Mr. Kushner well, but I think the odds are slim to none
Peter,
that anyone is going to be able to broker this.
And Peter, what about David Friedman, the man Donald Trump has named as ambassador to Israel? Tell us about him.
Well, he's an interesting guy. He's a bankruptcy lawyer in New York, but he's also very, very involved in Israel over the years. He owns an apartment in Jerusalem. He's been a supporter, financial and otherwise, for some of these West Bank settlements. And he feels very strongly about this. He's the big supporter of further expansion into the West Bank. He believes the embassy should be in Jerusalem. He said that he will work out of Jerusalem if and when he's confirmed as ambassador. And he's been pretty scathing about people who disagree with him. He's got a very sharp manner. He said that people like J Street, which is a more liberal version of a pro-Israeli group in Washington that favors, you know, more of a peace approach to policy. He said people like that, you know, aren't really Jews, and he compared them to capos, the Jews who cooperated with the Nazis in the concentration camps during World War II. So
wow.
He's a very outspoken person, and
yeah.
He's going to be an outspoken person, I think, if he's a confirmed ambassador.
And will he be confirmed?
Well, we haven't seen enough yet, I think, to get a sense of that. Obviously, there's some concern on the part of Democrats in Congress. The real question then becomes, are any Republicans worried about that as a signal to the region? But there's a pretty strong pro-Israel sentiment in Congress overall. And so, you know, so far we haven't seen any evidence that he would be blocked, but it's early yet.
What about Netanyahu? Is planning to come to Washington next month. Peter, what do we expect?
Well, we expect a pretty friendly gathering, unlike the many meetings that Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Obama had. You know, you'll remember as you go back and look at some of the pictures of some of those meetings, very stern looks on both President Obama's face and Prime Minister Netanyahu's face, because they just saw past each other. They talked past each other. They didn't connect. They didn't respect each other in a lot of ways. I think each of them saw the other in very negative terms. So even though the United States remained under President Obama, a very strong supporter of Israel to the point of providing, you know, $30-some billion over the next 10 years in aid, the two men were at odds. President Trump, on the other hand, and Prime Minister Netanyahu, if they met after the election, they've already forced at least something of a personal relationship. And I think you're going to see, the start of a different kind of era at this point.
Aaron?
I think that's right. You know, this is the third president that Mr. Netanyahu has dealt with. President Clinton, President Obama, and now Mr. Trump. And I suspect the Prime Minister will have a stake in demonstrating that he, in fact, can have a functional relationship with an American president. I think on the key issues, Israeli-Palestinian peace, Iran, the strategic relationship, defending Israel's back in the UN and in international fora, I think for now, for the moment, I think this will represent a new chapter. The question is how long is that chapter going to be?
So, Aaron, what do you see as the future of the two-state solution as we're sitting here now?
I mean, you know, I spent most of my professional life working on this issue, and I've concluded that, particularly on the Israeli-Palestinian issue, and sometimes we forget how much progress has been made in the Arab-Israeli arena. I mean, you have a functional peace treaty between Egypt and Israel. Relations are better now than any time since the peace treaty has been signed. You have a functional relationship between Israel and Jordan, and no one ever believed, myself included, that Jordan would be the second Arab head of state to sign a full treaty of peace with Israel. You probably won't have an Israeli-Syrian agreement. Israel will probably keep the Golan for the foreseeable future, and then some. The Israeli-Lebanese border will remain problematic. That leaves the Israeli-Palestinian issue. And, you know, Ben Franklin was right. Proximity breeds children, but it also breeds contempt. And I think the reality is that that proximity guarantees, virtually guarantees, that there will be no status quo that is comfortable or convenient for the parties. The problem is changing that status quo requires a degree of leadership on both sides that we have not yet seen, mm-hmm. and a degree of effective American mediation, almost certainly, which is going to require a healthy dose of not only honey, but a lot of vinegar too. And that's why I think you give me leadership, Diane, and you stand a reasonable chance of at least having a negotiation with effective American mediation to basically get close. Without leadership, without leaders who are masters of their political houses, not prisoners of their constituencies or their ideologies, the chances of getting close are slim to none.
And, Peter, isn't even the Israeli public itself divided on the two-state solution?
Well, I mean, it is and it isn't. I mean, I think it's still what a lot of people in Israel see as the most logical outcome. But I think there's a great deal of cynicism these days about the fact that it would ever actually happen. I think that all the things that Aaron just talked about make most Israelis think that the moment has kind of come and gone at this point, and there's a great deal of, fatalism almost at this point. I was at a dinner with some Palestinians, very leading Palestinians in the old city of Jerusalem just a couple months ago, and I asked them, I said, well, what's the outcome here? What's going to be like in 50 years? And they said in 50 years there still won't be a Palestinian state, that there is no good outcome at this point. And in fact, what you hear more and more on both sides for different reasons is the exploration, at least out loud, of the idea of a one-state solution, meaning what if, in fact, Israel and the West Bank were to be part of a single nation. Now, the Israelis look at this, the more right-wing Israelis look at this and think, well, we should annex it and we should just be in charge of it. That's what Naftali Bennett, one of the coalition members of Prime Minister Netanyahu, says. On the other side, you hear the Palestinians, some of them say, well, maybe we should go along with that as long as we have equal rights, because, in fact, they understand that demographically they eventually are going to outnumber, that Muslims will outnumber Jews, that Arabs will outnumber the Jewish population, and it will no longer be a Jewish state if, in fact, they had full voting rights. Unlikely that they would be given that. So it's a really interesting moment when the two-state solution feels very, very much on the edge of irrelevance.
You know, Peter, I think a lot of us here in Washington are curious about your own situation. You were going to be stationed in Jerusalem, and the next thing we know, you're back here in Washington as White House correspondent. How come? Yeah.
They kicked me out. No, I was there for about 5 months. I had a great time. I really enjoyed it. It's a fascinating place. I learned a lot, but there was still a lot to learn. But, you know, we'll call this a Trump effect. You know, we didn't, anticipate that this was going to be the next White House, and the paper decided to bring me home and bring me back to an old beat. It's a little like the recidivist who gets a call from the parole officer, you know, you have to go back.
All right, Aaron, and that's the last question. How different would this be between the Arabs and the Israelis and the United States had Hillary Clinton been elected?
I mean, I think the basic problems would remain the same. I think the acceleration of rushing toward the abyss would have been slowed down. I worry greatly that on so many issues facing this country at home and abroad, that we're in a completely different era with fewer constraints, much less discipline, much more partisanship, and a sort of headlong rush toward an unknown destination. And I think Hillary Clinton as president would have had the knowledge, the sensibility, the sensitivity. her team would have been well briefed, well prepared. Still, the fundamental obstacles that confront Israelis and Palestinians and Americans would still remain. This is a tough one, and I haven't abandoned hope for a solution, but I'm a lot more sober about what it's going to take to get there.
Peter, how do you see that?
Well, I think that's right. I mean, I think that what Aaron's point is that the fundamental problems are there regardless of who's president. And that's we've seen that now through multiple administrations and multiple approaches. And as long as the leadership on both sides doesn't really either want a solution or at least feel capable of doing what's necessary to get there, Americans can play only so far a role. Having said that, American leadership does matter. And, you have seen moments when, the simple lack of a process even proved harmful or damaging to the region. So sometimes even if you can't get to a solution, the simple act of being able to talk paid some benefits in keeping the lid on otherwise what can be a pretty violent and pretty tough situation. But I think Aaron's right. I mean, it's a very stolid moment in the process where there doesn't seem to be any bright lights on the horizon.
Aaron, one last question. Do you see this White House moving on Syria anytime soon?
I see this White House moving on certain pieces of Syria. I think they are going to try to seriously road test the proposition that somehow ISIS's demise can be accelerated by closer military cooperation with Putin and the Russians. I don't see the investment on the political side. I think in an effort to stem, you've seen they've canceled the Syrian refugee program. I think in an effort to stem further pressures for immigration, the incoming administration may be more amenable to creating some sort of humanitarian zones, although certainly not marshaled or policed by American ground forces. But I think by and large, if you thought Obama was risk averse on Syria, I suspect you're going to see even more risk aversion from this administration on the broader Syria problem, with the one exception, which is trying to accelerate. And I know Secretary of Defense Mattis is working on some sort of accelerated timetable here to try to demonstrate that this administration is doing more against ISIS than its predecessor.
But demonstrate. I think this is a stretch. How do you see that kind of demonstration working?
I mean, the formula that this president, the previous president had put together, which is essentially limited deployment of special forces, intelligence cooperation, reliance on local proxies, and air power, by and large, I think will be the template for the next one. I think there was talk, and again, I have no access to information that the two of you don't have. There has been talk about trying to accelerate and intensify the operation against the capital of the Islamic State at Raqqa. That, of course, would be, and I can hear this president talking quite boldly if, in fact, the Raqqa operation were accelerated. You see that we basically have now, hit the head of the snake, and basically it shows how tough and effective we are. That's still a tough problem. Who occupies Raqqa? What happens when it is occupied? What do you do about the Kurds? The Turks are upset. So there are a lot of unknowns here. I just suspect that in an effort to demonstrate that he's different than the previous president, that you are going to see some kind of new aspect to the anti-Islamic State operations.
And last question for you, Peter Baker. Where do you think the press is going to be moved to outside the White House?
Well, for the moment, the new White House team had talked about whether they might move the press out of the White House, out of the West Wing. For the moment, they seem to have backed off of that. We've had now a couple of three briefings in the briefing room. They've gone relatively smoothly. There doesn't seem to be any great hue and cry on the reporters' part to be moved to a bigger space. That was the reason given. So I think at the moment they've sort of given up on that, and we're back right where we are, and we'll see how long it lasts.
I must say I was interested to look at the front page of the New York Times yesterday or the other day and see the word lies. Is the New York Times going to be more forthcoming about putting that word out there?
Well, I think we're very, very cautious when we use a word like that. We understand it's a very tough word, it's a loaded word, so it's not done lightly. I think it's only been done a couple times, and I think it's done when we feel like there's the facts justify it. In this case, the president said things that he has been told is not true, that there doesn't seem to be any evidence for whatsoever, and he repeats it anyway. You know, I think the editors felt very strongly that that word was appropriate for that circumstance. We're not going to use it every day for every statement made by every politician that might be questionable, because the problem, you know, is I think some people would like us to label everything any politician says as a lie. We're not going to do that. But we are going to fact check, and we are going to hold accountable people in power, which is something we always do and always try to do.
Peter Baker and Aaron David Miller, thank you both very much.
Thank you, Diane.
Thank you. It's great talking to you.
Such thoughtful and articulate views on an issue that's likely to remain at the top of the agenda regarding Trump foreign policy. Our music was composed by Cliff Harden and used courtesy of WAMU's Capital Soundtrack Project. The show is produced by Sandra Baker and Rebecca Kaufman. This is Diane Rehm. I'll talk to you next week.